Justin Berger Jacobs. May it please the court, my name is Douglas Shackman, and I represent the appellant, the defendant below in this proceeding. This case focuses upon what the creditor's obligation is after they repossess collateral that's secured by personalty. And I stress personalty because of the strong tension between that and the actions of a creditor on a default upon the collateral of the realty. The standard of review for this court is de novo because the courts below misinterpreted the law to be applied in this case. We have the benefit here of a statute that specifically states what the creditor's burden is. 6 Delaware Code Section 9611, which for some prior cases was known as 9504, because in 1996 the General Assembly adopted the renumbering system that the National Commissioners had promulgated. It says every aspect of the disposition of collateral, including the method, manner, time, place, and other terms, must be commercially reasonable. Now, Onyx seeks to change this standard. First, it's enough if they operate in good faith. Well, as we all know, every uniform commercial code transaction requires good faith. That's a necessary, but it's certainly not a sufficient obligation. Second, they ask that they be interpreted as to whether most of their conduct satisfies it, some, or the overall flavor.
Well, Mr. Shackman, to cut through this, tell us what, in your view, the secured creditor was obligated to prove in order to satisfy the UCC test.
Thank you, Ron. What they were obligated to do is come forward with knowledgeable witnesses and documents showing what they did to dispose of the collateral.
Well, that was already done. But they did tell the court what they did to dispose of the collateral. Your argument is that what they did, or at least what they proved that they did, is not enough to satisfy the standard for commercially reasonable. And my question is, what is it? What additional evidence should they have introduced in the record to show that what they did in selling the repossessed car was commercially reasonable?
Your Honor, I would divide your question into two parts. First, I'll assume that the evidence which they introduced was admissible. And what they didn't do was they didn't bring anyone in, which is usually an auctioneer in this case, who would testify as to what the auction did. Of course, there could be...
We know what the auction did. You're asking us to compare what actually happened here against some hypothetical standard that you say wasn't met. The standard is not set forth with any precision. So what we have to do is deduce from the legal standard the type of evidence that's required, not just in this case, but in all cases. And I'll ask you a third time, what evidence, other than what actually happened here, had to be introduced?
What they didn't introduce is, I'm not sure if there is an assumption in your question that all auctions operate the same. There can be auctions which are grand, well-known, well-publicized, the Mannheim auction, Conshohocken auction, in which bidders come from miles, perhaps hundreds of miles away. Then there could be auctions that are set up kind of ad hoc, and what we don't know what they do. And that was the case here, that we don't know how that auction did its job. When the statute talks about the time, place, method, and manner, what we don't know is what the typical evidence is. What did this auction do to entice bidders? Did it send out notices? Did it advertise in a newspaper? Did it place notices in public places?
Well, there's no evidence that any of that was done, correct?
That's correct.
So we can assume that it wasn't done. The question is, what should have been done, and what should the evidence have been? It isn't enough to say they didn't do this, they didn't do that. We need to be able to tell the world, not just in this case, but in all cases, what a secured creditor must do when disposing of collateral in order to meet the test of commercial reasonableness.
Your Honor, I don't think you're seeking what I'm about to say, which is that this court will then say each secured creditor must follow step A, step B, step C, step D, because there can be many different ways of selling vehicles. That's why this court, back in the Connor case, said that the creditor, the burdens placed upon the creditor are minimal, and it is in control of the process. One creditor may choose to have a sale on its lot. Let's say, for instance, New Car Connection repossesses a car. Now, they have a very big operation, so they may choose to have it on their own lot. Someone else may choose to turn it over to an auctioneer. So I don't think that we can say that there is a way of doing things, or two, three, or four ways.
So how do we write the opinion, Mr. Shackman? Do we say we have no idea what commercially reasonable means in any real sense, but we know it when we see it, and this isn't it? Is that how we write the opinion?
No, Your Honor. I believe that the way that the opinion is written is that the creditor had the responsibility of putting forth evidence of what it did. It had the burden of proof.
We know what it did. What we don't know is what else it should have done.
Well, we don't know all of the ingredients of 611. We don't know, again, how it advertised. We don't know about the location, other than it was in Dallas, Virginia. And contrary to what the Onyx suggests, I don't think that the courts below ever said that everything in Northern Virginia is satisfactory, nor can we even say something in Dallas, Virginia. You could have someone who sets up a very poorly operated auction in Dulles, just as you could have one in Wilmington, Delaware.
Let me try it one last time.
I'm sorry.
If you were to express your argument in terms of a rule of law that would, which when applied to the facts of this case, would lead to a decision, what would that rule of law be in a paragraph or less, in a sentence?
That a creditor must produce at trial evidence of how it conducted its disposition, what it did to promote or market or advertise the disposition, where it conducted the disposition, how many people attended the sale, and according to Associated Finance versus DeMarco, whether that method comported with that of reputable businesses in the field.
There would, in other words, have to be some testimony about what in this particular field constituted reasonable commercial practices, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And was that evidence presented in this hearing?
No, Your Honor. In other cases, particularly the Hector case, which was cited by both the lower courts, they referred to the fact that an auctioneer had appeared at that trial. There was no auctioneer in this case. And the person who testified readily admitted that he had no knowledge of what actually happened at this auction. He wasn't even sure where it occurred. He did look at the documents and say it occurred in Virginia, but he didn't know anything more than that as to how the sale occurred.
Now, your position would then explain why we wouldn't be able to rely on sheriff sales and 50% or more of the value constituting some kind of prima facie or presumptive commercial reasonableness, because all sheriff sales are conducted the same way, correct?
Your Honor, I won't presume to know how they're conducted in Kent and Sussex counties, but if I may compare the two processes, a sheriff sale first does not occur until the court's already taken jurisdiction over the parties. It's going to take place because there's been a foreclosure, a mechanic's lien, a judgment, so the court already has the procedure. has jurisdiction over the case. The second thing is that everything is transparent. You have it being conducted by an officer of the court, not by just anyone somewhere in private. And the repossession cases, the repossession sales are frequently in private somewhere. The court has approved private sales, and of course the statute provides for that. That means they don't have to tell the debtor where it's going to be or what happens. They have a sale. When do we first know what happens? We know in a trial. When you compare the advertising, the sheriff is required to advertise in a certain way. They have to advertise in a newspaper of general jurisdiction, and they have to post notices.
So your position is in the private sale like we're dealing with here, at a minimum, there should be testimony explaining the process by which the sale was conducted and some evidence of how others conduct similar sales so the court can get a sense of what's the general practice in that area of commerce, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So there's no precise methodology that flows from the statute?
There is none.
But there has to be some testimony not only about what happened on this occasion, but how it compares with other similarly conducted sales.
We believe that flows from the DeMarco case, Your Honor.
Okay.
And again, the sheriff's sale shocked the conscience. As I've mentioned, there has to be public advertising. The sheriff does his business in the public. You have a sheriff's sale, used to be in the courthouse, now it's across the plaza in the city county building in Newcastle County. It's done, it's conducted first by the attorney for the sheriff. There's an auctioneer, and then there are anywhere from dozens to hundreds of people attending who have the ability to oversee, and if necessary, they could testify. No such occurrence in a repossession sale. We don't know anyone who will testify unless they have an auctioneer come, or unless a representative of the creditor attended the sale and said, I attended the sale, here's what we did. You know, we held it in the back lot of New Car. We held it at an auction. We had 100 people attend. It went through a line with, you know, 80 other cars. We advertised in the Washington Post or, you know, whatever it may be.
Okay, let's assume we've got that point now. What's the remedy that you see?
The remedy has been flowing since 1980 in the Connor case, that the creditor is not entitled to any deficiency. And the statute provides for statutory damages. And in this case, well, the statute actually has a formula for computing those, and that's 10% of the cash price of the vehicle, plus the finance charge, which in this case amounts to $6,046.
Can we get back to the evidence of commercial reasonableness here? Didn't someone from the repossessor's business testify that this is the way they've been doing it for 10 years, and they always use private auctions, and that this one basically went the way they all do?
Partially, Your Honor. What we had was, if you first take a look at how the witness was qualified, the witness testified that he has various duties at Onyx in the Philadelphia office. I emphasize Philadelphia. He never said he had anything to do with the repossession sales, that he never qualified that he had any personal knowledge of how they do repossession sales.
I thought he testified that they always do private auctions.
That's what I'm getting to, that is competency to make that statement. And he may have read somewhere.
Well, let's assume that he was competent to make that statement. Doesn't that bear upon whether the process was commercially reasonable?
Not for this particular sale, Your Honor, because there are private sales and there are private sales. As I use the hypothetical, you could have one where New Card is a private sale on its lot.
Right. I understand that there are better and worse private sales. But you seem to be suggesting that in order to prove commercial reasonableness, you have to establish exactly how this sale was carried out and how much advertising there was and what, you know, how many people showed up and so on and so forth. And that certainly would be one way of doing it. why can't it also be done, admittedly in a less specific fashion, but why can't it also be done by testimony that we're in the business of repossessing and disposing of vehicles, and this is the way we've done it for 10 years, and it was done pretty much the way we've always done it. The fact that we've done it for 10 years and we got a price that was arguably reasonable, why isn't that enough?
Because there's two components to the hypothetical testimony you just described. Part of this opinion testimony.
Well, let's assume it's fact testimony that we did it the same way on this car as we've done it for the last 10 years.
This witness didn't have the confidence.
Let's assume the witness said that. What would be wrong with that as evidence of commercial reasonableness?
Because the statute doesn't allow for just that. The statute has specific requirements. You can't just say, this is the way we've always done it, and we did it this way. The statute has specific components, time, place, method, manner of sale.
We know the time, place, method, and manner of sale. We know it was in Virginia. We know it was a private sale. We know, I assume, what date it was done.
Those aren't the way that other courts have interpreted that to be just those bare facts. They have said that you have to have evidence of the quality of what the components were. It can't just be a city and state. It has to be what was the, how popular was the sale, or how many bidders occurred, and how well publicized it was. We don't even know how it was publicized, if it was publicized. And so we get back to, if the witness merely makes a self-serving statement that this is the way we do it, and we have no components to cross-examine the witness on, then we can't determine whether or not it meets the standards of how a reasonable automobile dealer, in this case, would have sold collateral.
Thank you.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Jacobs, Justice Berger. May it please the Court, my name is Daniel Carrick. I represent the Appellee Onyx Acceptance Corporation. Your Honor, this case before the Court should affirm the lower court's decision for two reasons. The evidence that was relied on by the trial judge was admissible pursuant to the business records exception. And second, the trier of fact, based on the deductive process, a logical process, looked at substantial evidence to make the determination that the sale of the repossessed collateral was commercially reasonable.
Can you just tell us what the evidence was of the way the sale was conducted?
Certainly. The evidence that was presented at trial was submitted through Mr. Jimenez. Mr. Jimenez testified about the activity notes related to Onyx's files, the recondition reports, and he also discussed the fact, as Your Honor previously mentioned, that the Onyx Acceptance long-standing practice was to sell repossessed vehicles at private sales.
Okay, but tell us about what evidence there was of this particular sale and how it was conducted.
Your Honor, the only thing that we know about the private sales that was conducted in Dulles, Virginia, at a private auction, and we know this because of the recondition reports and the business records of Onyx.
So we don't know whether anybody, whether two people showed up or 100 people, whether it was advertised, where the location actually was in terms of whether it was in a place that one would expect to get a big crowd or not. We know none of those facts.
Your Honor, we do not. And I think the question that is important is whether that is required under the code.
Well, isn't something required? Is something more than just this is the way we do it?
Well, I think that depends on the circumstances. It depends on all of the evidence that are presented before the court. It would certainly be preferable to have the auctioneer present. It would be preferable to have the individual that repossessed the vehicle present to testify in court. It would be preferable to have the individual in the California office of Onyx who had firsthand knowledge and took all this information down in their computers. But I think
somebody in California had firsthand knowledge of what was going on in occupied Virginia when this sale occurred?
Now, my understanding of the testimony is that Onyx is a large operation. It's now actually Capital One Auto Finance. They have offices all throughout the country. They're very compartmentalized. You have certain departments taking care of certain duties. And the testimony at trial was that individuals in California were maintaining electronic notes. And these electronic notes are shared throughout the corporation. They're used to make business decisions on behalf of the entire company.
Well, tell me what the trial judge had before him or her that led to the logical deductive process that you allege took place. How did the judge conclude on the facts presented that this was commercially reasonable?
I think the trial judge looked at, started with price, and the document that was submitted was a page from a Kelley Blue Book, a widely distributed book that will give price quotations for wholesale and retail vehicles. The price quotation that the Kelley Blue Book gave was based on a mileage that was listed on the recondition report, the vehicle condition report, of approximately 57,000 miles. The evidence that was also submitted that is important with respect to mileage is the title. When the vehicle was sold to the appellant in 2000, the mileage listed approximately 84,000. So the judge made a logical deduction that somehow the mileage had been tampered with or was inaccurate. So the price had to be adjusted to reflect the fact that it would be very unlikely that the mileage would be less after 4 years of driving the vehicle. So the judge took the Kelley Blue Book price and reduced it. That's would have been the first step in terms of determining a what is a commercially reasonable price for this vehicle. The second factor with respect to price were the repairs. This was apparently a vehicle that was in need of repair. The condition report identified within Onyx documents and the ABC auction documents identified necessary repairs of approximately $1,350. So the judge took that from the Kelley Blue Book price, the reduction in mileage, and then the reduction in repairs, because there was no evidence submitted that the repairs were completed, and reduced that Kelley Blue Book price to an amount which it believed was more than 50% of the wholesale price.
Let me just ask again the question asked by Justice Berger. We don't know from the record how many bidders showed up. Is that right?
That's right.
What information was disseminated in the trade to alert interested, potentially interested bidders that there was going to be a repossession sale?
That's correct.
And no evidence as to how repossession sales are conducted by other reputable dealers in this area or in any other area. Is that right? That is geographic area.
Correct.
Okay. Secondly, was aside from the actual price that was achieved in this sale, was there any evidence in the record as to a higher price that might have potentially been available, or for which that would have been a reasonable price, a strike price at an auction for this particular car?
Your Honor, I don't believe the retail price, I believe, was presented with the Kelley Blue Book price, the wholesale price.
So just the Blue Book price?
Right. There was a retail price and a wholesale price. And because of the nature of the sale, the private auction, it was determined that this was not, it appears as though the judge, in reviewing the materials, determined that the retail price should not apply, and I would submit that there are certain merchandising techniques that would take place that would provide you with the ability to make a decision.
The judge assumed, apparently, that sales of this kind, no one ever overpays for the vehicle.
I would...
Because it looks like the judge simply focused here not on any of the details of how the sale was conducted, the advertising, similarity, the sales of similarly situated vehicles, and all the rest of that. The judge focused on the price and determined that under these circumstances, the price looked like it was reasonable. End of story, right?
I think the judge looked at the price, looked at the condition of the vehicle, looked at the evidence that was submitted, looked at the need for repairs. I don't think it was the price alone.
Well, then what, all the things you just mentioned go to the price.
Well, I think they're important. We look at the mileage, we look at the vehicle, we look at what the secured creditor has to do here. The secured creditor has to take an 11-year-old vehicle and essentially control the damage that it's suffering. This is an individual debtor who's in default for 90 days. This piece of collateral is depreciating every day. This secured creditor's faced with making a decision as to what do we do with this vehicle? Do we assign it for repossession? How can we maximize the value of what we have left of this asset? So I think what the trial judge was forced to do is look at the price, look at the potential hoops that the secured creditor has to jump through. I think the appellant, what they're requesting and they're asking this court to do is make secured creditors jump through hoops, essentially, that are not reasonable and maybe not practical. The secured creditor certainly has an obligation to act with good faith and make decisions based on this imprecise standard of commercial reasonability.
Well, if I understand what you're driving at, you seem to be suggesting that when you've got a company that's got nationwide offices and is in the business of providing credit and then unfortunately dealing with defaults and having to dispose of the collateral, that whatever system that company sets up, if in this case it's private sales at a location near Washington, D.C., then there should be some credit given to the idea that that must be commercially reasonable if, on top of that, you evaluate the price that was obtained and the price looks not unreasonable, that there really shouldn't have to be anything more than just the fact that this is the way we do business and we would only do business in a commercially reasonable way because we're in the business of trying to recover as much as we can on our debt.
Well, I think the trier of fact is always going to be the ultimate decision maker as to what is commercial and reasonable. But secured creditors, they look to the statute for guidance. We look at the private sale. It's an accepted method of sale under the UCC. We look at the points raised by the appellant, advertising. We look at evidence of prevailing trade practices. And in private auction, it's unclear as to whether advertising is needed. Clearly, advertising is important in certain cases because we want to make sure that there are bidders on cars.
Well, I think the question that you were asked, at least as I understand it, is whether, even though there is no evidence of how other dealers conduct private repossession sales, whether because this particular secured creditor has nationwide offices, its practices, whatever they may be, are presumptively commercially reasonable. Is that your position?
I'm not suggesting that their practices specifically should be presumed to be commercially reasonable. I'm suggesting that the evidence that was submitted based on the price and all the other factors were determined by the trier fact to be commercially reasonable.
All the other factors, I'm still hung up on that. Can you convince me that the trial judge considered anything other than price when he reached the conclusion, the evident conclusion, that this was a commercially reasonable auction?
Well, I believe I'm going back into the mileage and repairs again, but I think all of the aspects surrounding the car, everything that can be discussed with respect to the mileage, the repairs, the location of the sale. All of those items were found by the judge to be commercially reasonable. So in terms of the evidence that was submitted, the activity notes, the notice of sale, the condition reports, and the witness testimony. The witness testimony testified about his experience in the same or similar matters, looking at...
Did he testify that he not only did not attend this sale, but he had never attended any auction at Dulles?
That's correct. He had not attended. But he had looked at the same or similar documents in terms of the condition reports from the dealers and the auction sites in other Onyx files. So the trial judge was forced with having to make the decision as to whether these documents are trustworthy, whether this individual's testimony is reliable, and he found that they were. He found that these documents were reliable and trustworthy based on the witness's 10 years of experience, based on his decisions with assigning vehicles to repossession and dealing with the
limitations. Well, so what you're saying is that we've got evidence as to value, and that deals with the condition of the car and the mileage and the year and make and the blue book information and so forth. We've got evidence as to value. We've got evidence that this is the standard practice of your company, mainly to have private auctions. And we've got evidence that this particular auction took place just outside of Washington, D.C., and I guess you can take judicial notice that that's a highly populated area of the country. But that's it, right? In terms of commercial reasonableness?
Your Honor, I believe that you've identified the factors that are listed within Article 9, 6, 10, the method, manner, time, place. Those are the factors, those are the guidelines. And presenting evidence to meet those factors is what the trial court had to make a decision
on. Well, let's just take one of those. Let's assume that Dulles is a highly populated area. What difference does that make if no one in that highly populated area knows there's an auction taking place and on a particular day at a particular time, or what's being auctioned, because there is no or insufficient publicity to put them on notice? What do we know, and what did the trial court or trial judge know about the extent to which the sale was, information was disseminated to potential buyers?
The only evidence, again, that was presented was the condition report and the activity notes that identified that the sale took place, and the condition reports of ABC, which listed.
Well, yeah, okay, they're condition reports. Assume for a moment that I haven't read them, and answer my question.
Your Honor, there wasn't evidence as to what happened at the auction, and all.
And there's no evidence to any pre-auction process publicity that would give notice to people in this highly populated area that there was an auction taking place, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And I think, again, the question is that required under the code?
So if it had been held in a Mojave Desert, would it have made any difference if there was no publicity?
Well, I think then we would probably run into problems with the place if we're dealing with the repossession.
Well, I'm very confused. If no one knows the auction, well, it's not if a tree falls in the woods, does it make a sound go? But if no one knows this auction is taking place, what difference does it make that it's in a highly populated area?
Well, I don't know that it makes any difference. I think what's important here is the purpose of advertising is to have prospective bidders and to sell the repossessed vehicle. This vehicle was sold within a month of repossession, which, if you look to prior cases, there certainly is an issue in terms of the time lapse between repossession and sale. This is a vehicle that sold within 1 month. Your Honor, apparently there was someone or an entity that purchased this vehicle at this sale. So I would suggest that advertising certainly has its purpose in a public auction. With respect to a private auction, we don't know that that's required under the code.
Mr. Carrick, you're making an argument essentially at the ground level, but when we're deciding what the law is and what it should be, sometimes you have to do it from 30,000 feet. So the question I'm going to ask you, and it's basically the same question I asked Mr. Shackman, is what, in your view, what is the minimal evidence required to show commercial reasonableness as a legal matter?
I think the evidence that's needed is going to depend on a case-by-case basis. I think it's a subjective finding. I think the factors that are identified in Article 9, 6, 10 provide guidance. And I think that you can have certain factors and not have other factors, and a trial court could find that that was a commercially reasonable sale.
Is if the only evidence consists of what happened in this particular sale, minus any evidence of what was done to attract bidders, and minus any evidence of what the custom and the trade was for this type of sale, under what rule of law could we conclude that this sale was commercially reasonable? Can you articulate that rule of law?
Well, I believe the lower court, in Judge Small's opinion, when he discussed the totality of circumstances surrounding the sale, I think that's exactly what Article 9, 6, 10 describes. It describes that every aspect must be commercially reasonable. So I feel that the rule of law would be that in order for a sale to be commercially reasonable, the factors identified in the code would have to be looked at on a case-by-case basis in order for the judge to make that type of decision. And it's an imprecise standard. There's no way that I can give you an exact point other than saying it's an imprecise standard, and each case should be looked at based on all the factors that are identified in Article 9, Section 610. But I believe my time is about to conclude.
All right.
We'll just request again, respectfully request that you please affirm the lower court's decisions based on the finding of commercial reasonability and the finding to judge that the records were admitted pursuant to the business records exception. Thank you.
Could I start off with a slight twist on what we have here, certainly, but could price alone ever be sufficient to establish commercial reasonableness? Let's say the car was repossessed and they got 75% of Blue Book value. Would you still be able to argue that, well, you know, they have to prove commercial reasonableness, and that's that includes time, place, manner, and so forth, and you know, they've got to come in with evidence and experts and what have you, and establishing that they got a fair price is not enough.
Your Honor, I'm torn, I guess, between saying that hard facts make bad law as to whether or not you have a situation where the price seems so high and you're going to throw out all the factors. I don't think as a matter of how courts evaluate this, that the answer is yes, that you could say because a high price was reached, because one of the things that may not be taken into account is that Kelly Blue Book may be an ordinary car. Maybe somebody at some point has so souped up the car or done something that it's a high, much more valuable than Kelly Blue Book. That's what kind of throws to me your question.
So you're saying that even if the price itself strongly suggested that the process must have been fair and reasonable, in your view, it would be the burden of the creditor to actually put on evidence of how the auction was conducted and how it was advertised and how many people showed up and that sort of thing.
That's correct. Under your example, the creditor could move for summary judgment and say, we received 75% of Kelly Blue Book, we asked the court enter judgment without a trial. And while many of these cases are decided on summary judgments to notice, I've never seen anyone decided on commercial reasonableness. With regard to your earlier question about whether or not there can be some sort of a presumption that the financial institution being nationwide globalized sense, if ever we had a $300 billion example of financial institutions aren't always prudent and don't always operate in the proper manner, we have it now. More specifically, if we take a look at the decision of Judge DeSabatino in Hutchton, where he said that in his years on the bench, appeared in many different cases, he had never seen where a bank produced as many as four bidders for their process.
Sorry, Mr. Sackman, your time is up.
Thank
you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.